Totally Football Show. Coming up in today's big football stories, there's England's nil-nil in Croatia and Monday's trip to Seville. There's the Netherlands, Gibraltar, Achtung Baby as Germany face the drop, and Scotch on the rocks after their trip to Haifa. All that, plus Monaco news. How will Thierry Henry get on at the Louis II, the one ground that's emptier than that one in Rijeka? All that and more in this Totally Football Show.
Rabiot, now Savicevic. Panucci had made the overlap, but look who's back there defending, Ravanelli. Now Baggio, just feeling his way back really into the senior side after his lengthy layoff. Ravanelli, Otto Viali here, looking to extend Baresi, good shot, and Rossi down with a save.
Well, today's show starting off there with a tribute to Peter Brackley. I think always my favourite commentator, and sad that he's gone so early, just 67. I was sad that we didn't get so much chance of late to hear his work. Lovely to hear him there pronouncing, delivering some of the great names. And, of course, he was so understated, but him and Ray Wilkins, but that team was as big a part of anything that made Italian football a success in the 90s. What a man he was. What a wit as well. There's a documentary actually which BT Sport did back at the start of the year, which will be replayed this evening in tribute to Peter, who was such a key part of that show. And a lovely moment from that, which we'll just play now.
I remember one week I had to remind Ray that because of his pace and his power, Cafu, wonderful Brazilian right back, you might remember, played for Roma and Milan. Because of his pace and power, he was known as Il Pendolino, which in Italian meant the super fast express train. I said, Ray, where's you when you played in Italy? Of course, it was known as Il Stoppa di Napoli, the stopping service to Naples. He said, well, that's where you're wrong, he said, Mr. Smart Alec. He said, because I happen to know that that particular service didn't run on a match day. No, I said, but then neither did you.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Now, listener, with us today on the Totally Football Show, we've got Daniel Story.
Good morning, James.
Who watched Croatia, England.
I did, yes.
Excellent, from a hill, I hope.
Yeah, not quite, but huge respect to those supporters who hadn't missed a game in 10 years, but we are going to watch this football match.
Absolutely. Jack Lang, you've had some skirting put up in your house, Jack.
What a thrilling way to introduce me, James. Yes, I have.
It's a shame they didn't show that instead of Croatia nil, England nil.
They were equally enjoyable, believe you me.
And also, ooh, Raphael Honigstein. You had goals in Germany's game, didn't you?
Loads of goals, yeah. I don't know which game you're referring to, because I saw two this weekend. One was Germany-Holland.
Yes.
3-0. The other one was Per Mertesacker. His testimonial, his old 96 Hannover friends against a World 22, I guess.
And oh,
I
lovely.
Think it ended 10-9. So
10-9.
Yeah, did he get on the score sheet?
He did get on the score sheet.
Right. Excellent. We'll speak about that later on. Of course, exciting times for Germany and Bayern Munich fans.
That's one way to put it.
Mm. Also coming up today, we'll have Andrew Slaven in a bit to tell us some spectacular news about Scotland. And Julien Laurent, cheeky Julien. He'll be on the phone to preview France's clash with Germany and also tell us why Thierry Henry, after turning down Bordeaux for not being ambitious enough, has joined the third bottom side in Ligue 1. So looking forward to that. Let's begin, though, with League of Nations Internationals. It's not called that, is it? Nations League. Mostly a low-scoring weekend for anyone who wasn't playing Germany. Scotland got beaten. Italy winning and consigning Poland to relegation. Germany in danger of dropping out of the top league as well. England, meanwhile, 0-0 with Croatia in a game so quiet you could hear the beeping of a truck as it reversed outside the stadium. A lot of people saying, Daniel, that this game was evidence of how important the fans are to football.
Well, yeah, absolutely, 100%. And I think there's certainly an argument that while Croatia's punishment was probably valid, and UEFA has struggled with to find alternative punishments, because basically the fines they have available to them are so small that when a nation has a swastika mowed onto the pitch as Croatia did, then the only possible punishment is to not allow any fans in. But it did feel like maybe England fans should have been allowed in. It felt like England were being punished for Croatia's crime. And it was a very bizarre game. All the players said it, all the journalists there said it, and it just felt more like a friendly than a friendly does.
As much as this game being evidence that football needs fans, was it not also evidence that football needs a bit of football being played?
Yeah, this Nations League is a very, in its infancy, is a very odd concept in that some international managers clearly view it as a competitive fixture. Others view it as a kind of semi-competitive and a chance to breed in youngsters. And some are actually using it as just as basically hardly even a friendly, just as a kind of fly in the ointment of post-World Cup preparation. And I think playing other elite nations, while was initially seen as a very positive thing, actually it places a huge amount of pressure on international managers, because if they then lose those games and suffer relegation, that feels like it can, you know, Germany is a very good example. It feels like very quickly after a major tournament, another disaster is around the corner.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think in Germany there is a view that this is actually a good thing. Not that disaster is around the corner, but the fact that Germany will not now, after bad World Cup, go straight into a very easy qualification group, winning lots of games. The problems that we've seen in Russia not really coming to the forefront against opposition of very limited quality, now that they are playing against teams who are at least as good as they are, maybe even better in the case of France, you suddenly see where the fault lines are. And maybe it's better to happen now than 2 years down the line at a tournament. So,
or in the European qualifications.
Yeah, I think it's going to be, I mean, even if Germany were to get relegated and only seeded in the second pot, because it's the Euros and almost everyone can turn up, it still doesn't really have that competitive edge to it for those bigger nations. But I think the view is almost, despite the bad results in Germany, that it's actually been a really good competition. Because it means something. And in the case of Germany and Löw, it could mean quite a lot if they were to lose on Tuesday night in France.
Also worth remembering that it's not just the European teams that is affected. There's been a bit of nascent backlash in South America over the fact that there aren't as many dates available for what would be viewed as glamorous friendlies.
So money-spinning
South American
friendlies.
Teams have been playing mainly in Central North America, in the Middle East. I think Peru had a couple of games against big European teams in the last window, but this time there's been no gaps in the schedule for any of those teams, so it's affecting those sides as well.
I saw James Rodriguez's goal against USA. That was quite something, wasn't
it? Very nice. Yeah, from James. And really the main attraction this week for the South American teams is Argentina v Brazil in Saudi Arabia.
When's that?
Tuesday night.
Oof. Now, England anyway get quite a useful point in their battle with relegation in their group. Spain coming up Monday night in Seville. There's certainly going to be some atmosphere there. Mm. The match probably will also have happened by the time most folk listen to this, which puts us in a bit of a position. Spain in banging form. Who saw their game against Wales? Daniel.
Yeah, they are probably, as bizarre as it sounds, so close to a World Cup, probably the best team in the world at the moment, I think. It hammers home. You know, the positive spin is that they have bounced back from the World Cup. The flip side is that it highlights just what a shambles that pre-World Cup debacle in which the manager lost his job for outright flirtation with Real Madrid. And you know, that did cost Spain their World Cup chance.
Right. Hey, what about Paco Alcacer?
Yeah, it's amazing. You will have the stats ready. I don't. But I can tell you that he has been unbelievable success in the Bundesliga, where despite not even starting many times, he scored lots of goals. And of course, he's now continued his form into the Spanish national team. And I think in Barcelona, it's already being seen as a bit of embarrassment that perhaps they made a mistake here. Conversely, he seems to be really happy. It's a loan deal with an option to buy. It's already signed and sealed. So he seems to be willing to stay beyond that deal. And once again, I think you have to take your hat off to Dortmund's scouting department, because he is not someone who would have been very high on the list of many Champions League teams looking for a centre forward, especially because he's, you know, slight and not really your orthodox number nine. But he's really released this Dortmund team, and maybe he can be the guy that makes the puzzle sort of complete for Spain, who've struggled a little bit to find the perfect centre-forward for their game. They tried Costa. Rodrigo is a better fit, but I think with Alcacer, who's maybe kind of a combination of all the good things that these other guys can bring, they look even better. And it's been an amazing few weeks for him.
You look at the number of options Spain now have in attack. Granted, yeah, perhaps not one of them until Alcacer has really grasped their chance fully, but there are so many different players that can play in those roles, like Asensio, Rodrigo, as Rafa said. Iago Aspas has made an impact. I don't think he was in the squad for the first couple of games until Costa got injured, but made a good impact. Lots of guys, even with Isco injured, they've got so much talent in those positions. And then you look at the three players who have, the only three players who have started all the games under Luis Enrique, De Gea and Ramos, probably predictable. But Saul is the one that's interesting, because I think I mentioned when I was on here before, he didn't play a single minute at the World Cup. Made a massive impact under Luis Enrique so far. And yeah, bad news for England is that Spain haven't lost a competitive home game in 15 years.
Yeah.
James, the bad news for England is also that the midfield three for Spain look as if they'll be Busquets, Thiago and Saul up against Harry Winks, Ross Barkley and Eric Dier.
Right. Hendo suspended.
Yeah, Winks has basically been brought into this team as this kind of, what Southgate calls his pass builder, I think he said, which is effectively someone to Busquets-esque kind of control the tempo of the game and play the most passes, like this kind of, I think I saw someone cleverly refer to it as half man, half Busquets. But no, this is a huge test of young England, because they could well be embarrassed by that midfield, I think.
And they could still get relegated from this group. I don't think it's a possibility that's been talked about that much after the Croatia game, but I felt there was a bad result considering that you're basically taking on Croatia on neutral ground almost. Maybe it's even a disadvantage for them. And they didn't really do all that well against this Croatia side, so I think that could still be problematic for Southgate.
We'll finish off the group at home to Croatia at Wembley, and when has that ever gone badly?
Exactly.
Okay, give the listeners a chuckle with a wayward or a shiver at a spookily accurate prediction. Jack?
I think Spain will win 3-1.
2-0 Spain.
Rafa?
Yeah, 2-0.
Really?
I'm gonna say as well, yeah.
Okay. Excellent. Let's have not excellent, obviously, if you're an England fan, but let's move on. In League B, defeat for Northern Ireland against Austria. Arnautović bundling through to score the only goal in that game, and Northern Ireland amongst those in danger of dropping down a tier. Ireland, similar for them, they drew 0-0 with Denmark. They only managed 3 shots, the Irish. The Danes had 15, but still a point. It's better than the last time. They host Wales on Tuesday night. That's going to be a big game, Ireland-Wales. Remember, it's Denmark 4 points, Wales on 3, Ireland now on 1.
Yeah, I think this could potentially be the end game for Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane. The principal reason to have Keane in a camp, and to an extent O'Neill as well, is man motivation and kind of making the players feel they're bigger and better than they are. And I mean, that game against Denmark was the opposite of that. There's actually some decent new talent in that Irish team. The likes of, Matt Doherty, who's playing brilliantly at Wolves, but they just seem to slump at international level at the moment. I don't think they've got long.
Yeah, Keane briefly last week suggested that he might be willing to dip back into club management, maybe in the Championship. But he hasn't thought about any options because, in his own words, I don't network.
Yes.
Which I thought would make an excellent title for his autobiography if he ever has a new one.
Very nice. What a read that would be. Anyway, that game coming up with Wales on Tuesday night, 4-1, of course, to the Welsh when they met in Cardiff. Scotland, you will recall we were talking about them riding high after they did a win over Albania. They headed to Haifa last Thursday after our show to take on an Israel side who, as we mentioned, had only beaten Andorra and Liechtenstein at home in the last 4 years. Andrew Slaven from the Totally Scottish Football Show joins us now. Andrew, I saw they went 1-0 up Scotland with a penalty on 25 minutes. So how many did he win by?
We got a penalty and we were 1-0 up at half-time and we were still rubbish. It was really poor. We lost 2-1.
Scotland had a man sent off.
Yeah, that's right. John Souter picked up a second yellow for what looked, on first sight, an elbow on De Boer, who plays for Salzburg. And when you look at the replays, there's no contact. So it was really unfortunate for Suter.
Was Scotland unlucky in general, or was this a fair result?
No. Israel were by far the much better team, and that's what frustrates Scotland fans, because a team who's not won at home in just over 2 years, and a Scotland team who's supposed to be on the rise with a lot of exciting young players, and they just can't turn up on a really important night.
Well, this was the same 11, I think, that had beaten Albania.
That's correct, so, yes. Same system as well, three at the back. Wing-backs with Robertson and O'Donnell from Kilmarnock. But there seems to be this pressure to play Kieran Tierney from Celtic, who's a hot talent up in Scotland, and Andrew Robertson, who's obviously captain of Scotland and plays for Liverpool. People playing out of position is causing a few problems, particularly away from home.
Israel can't stop winning at home now, because they went and followed that up by then winning again at home, making a mockery of my suggestion that they don't have a good record at home. They beat Albania now, so they are on top of the group, bizarrely. How does that affect Scotland's chances?
Well, I'm going to stay positive for Scotland, because we've still got two more games to play. We've got to play Albania next on the 17th of November. That's in Albania, so we need to turn our away form around. And then we've got Israel at home, right, 3 days after that. So if we win our next two games, everything's fine. And Alex McLeish will be fine. And Scotland will be fine,
okay,
I think.
What about the friendly with Portugal on Sunday night?
Yeah, so this was one thing where after that Israel result, everyone in Scotland was just like, why are we playing this 3-5-2 system? Players out of position. McLeish actually resorted back to a back four for that game, and it was better, I guess, because Portugal are who they are, although it was a reserve side. But they still have better technically gifted players, and some of the goals were excellent. Bruma's in particular, the third goal for Portugal.
Okay.
But Scotland's goal as well was quite a good finish. You know, we had Gary Mackay-Stephen, who plays for Aberdeen, flicking back for Stephen Naismith from Hearts. It was the first time since 1994 that Scotland had four Aberdeen players in the squad, which is quite an interesting stat. So
it certainly is. Yeah. It certainly is. All right. Well, you'll be talking about this more, no doubt, in the Totally Scottish Football Show coming up later on Monday or early Tuesday.
Yes, that's correct. We'll be dissecting the dismal performance in Israel. We're also going to try and heal our hearts a little bit. We're going to look back to one of Scotland's best ever results, when we played France in 2007.
Under Alex McLeish,
the last time when Alex McLeish's managerial career looked so promising, and now it's not looking so promising. But it was certainly one of the best results in my lifetime. So I can't wait to look back on that with my friends and kind of feel better about myself.
Yeah, don't look forward, look back.
That's exactly.
Yeah. Excellent.
I was living in France at the time of that, and James McFadden was going through a bizarre purple patch, and all these French people were asking me, who is this James McFadden? He's brilliant. And that really didn't last very long, did it?
It almost never would have been for James McFadden, because he missed his flight on his first cap. He'd played, I think it was South Africa. It was one of the four games that they played in that time in 2002. And James McFadden, because it was his first cap, he missed his flight back to Scotland. So, but the saving grace was because...
Why? Because it was his first cap, he missed the flight back to...
I think he went out after the game and enjoyed himself a bit too much. But his saving grace was Roy Keane walked out of the Ireland squad at the time, so... He got off the plane and he thought, oh my God, all this paparazzi are here. I only play for Motherwell. Why are they here for me? But they were there for Roy Keane.
Roy Keane took the heat.
A bit more, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, more top details like that in the Totally Scottish Football Show coming up on Monday evening.
He lines up to hit it, and yes! It's deflected for a corner! That's over 12 corners! Yes! No time to take it, though. It's finished 0-0. What a result!
Sorry, our fault. You see, with same-game multibets from Paddy Power, you can combine multiple selections from one match into one bet, and you'll get money back as a free bet if one leg of your fourfold same-game multibet lets you down. Paddy Power, enough of the nonsense. Applies to pre-match fourfold same-game multibets on UK and top European leagues. Max free bet £10 per customer per day. Minimum odds. Exclude shop bets. T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
On Spotify, smart speaker and podcast platforms everywhere, this is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
All right, Andrew Slaven of the Totally Scottish Football Show. Connor Walsh writes in, he says, Would international football be better if it was made up of players who play in each country rather than where they're born or their grandparents are born? Also, would mean it would change up every year. For example, now how will Ronaldo do for the Serie A team? Let's find out, says Connor. I like that idea. It has been done before.
Yeah, well, I mean, what he's talking about there is not international football. It's a new thing entirely.
Well,
I mean, everyone plays plenty of football anyway.
Call it the League of Leagues.
League of Leagues. There you go.
I think I actually did that in an article last a couple of years ago.
And what was your conclusion?
It must have been so memorable that I can't even.
But they used to. This used to happen. There used to be a Serie A team. I'm sure that an English team is a first division team back. You know, before the Premier League took on. I think.
Yeah, it feels very. It feels a very modern kind of computer game thing to have this kind of composite 11 of each league. I suppose if you had just the top four leagues in Europe playing off over a summer, but
yeah, there is one game at the end of the season. I say one game, but one little kind of the top five or six leagues will invite
that's
France
the 39th
as well.
Game and do it in, I don't know, do it in Dubai or something. And yeah, not for me.
Aruba would be my pick. Okay, but, yeah,
someone called Javier Tebas from the Spanish Federation.
Yeah,
get a ridiculous far-flung country involved. I think we could have a go here.
Excellent. Good. Oh, well, here's another tweet. This from Danny Last. Danny says, was that Rafa's actual vinyl record collection in the backdrop of his recent Copper 90 Hamburg video? Fave albums of all time for those gathered in the studio. Well, we don't need to get into that.
No.
But that was... Did you artfully do your interview in front of your vinyl collection?
I did, yeah.
How many vinyl records have you got?
I haven't counted for a long time.
Are we talking in the hundreds or the thousands?
No, it's a good couple of thousands.
Jeepers. Rafa, I have to say, is wearing a Run DMC sweatshirt and a, as you know, used to be a DJ. That's not a new purchase, is it? That's
no,
an old school.
Not that old school, but...
Okay, because you wore your other one out. Yeah, excellent. What's your favourite Run DMC track? Can't say Greatest Hits.
Tricky.
Yeah.
For me, Rockbox. Do you remember Rockbox?
I just made a joke.
Oh, it's Tricky! Sorry! Wow, listener. Now, bad times for Scotland, as Andrew was just explaining. Worst times for Germany, though. Raphael Honigstein.
That's awful.
3-0 away... Where was it? Amsterdam, no? Yep. Johan Cruyff.
Mm-hmm.
Van Dijk. Memphis Depay kind of brought back memories of Del Piero's goal in 2006. Unwelcome memories, of course, for some. The second goal. Because
Counter-attack, yeah.
Van Dijk had put you 1-0 down. Mm-hmm. And then there was this kind of late flurry of goals kind of in the 87th and then 92nd or something. Yeah. Depay and then Wijnaldum, which... I know that Yogi Love touched on this, but that must be really worrying, not just to lose, but also the way they kind of collapsed at the end, Germany.
Well, it was a little bit like the loss against South Korea when Neuer started playing as a striker that Löw kind of made light of it, saying that, of course, you know, you chase the game, these kind of things happen. It wasn't necessarily reflective of our performance. Mats Hummels made a similar case, saying, actually, yeah, we lost 3-0, but we played pretty decent football here at times, and... we didn't take our chances, and this can happen. And that kind of attitude didn't really go down well with the public, because it's increasingly seen as one of the problems that some of the more experienced players, some of the more experienced people in case of Löw, perhaps don't quite see the extent of the problem. Always
the
trying
numbers
to look beyond the result, but the results themselves are pretty scary.
Yeah, the numbers make it all too apparent. It's now 6 defeats in 10 games. Indeed, in the last year, the only teams that Germany managed to win against, Sweden in the World Cup, thanks to that last-minute Toni Kroos goal, and friendly results over Saudi Arabia and Peru. The 3-0 defeat away in Amsterdam equals Jogi Löw's worst ever loss in his 168 games in charge. And Daniel, what's that? They haven't scored now in 3 games.
Yeah, for the first time in their history, I believe.
So
and they're also the only team not to have scored in the Nations League alongside Estonia and Malta, I think, and maybe a couple more. But I mean, yeah, it's
one of
bad.
The few.
It's bad.
So and there's a risk now of a real risk of relegation in that group with Netherlands and France. France game's huge. You've got that one coming up on Tuesday, and then Netherlands away
in Paris.
in November. Oh, no, you host Netherlands in November. But what does it need? Does it need another reboot? Does it need just a centre forward? What's missing?
Well, I mean, the problems that Germany used to have in specific areas, they managed to compensate because the core of the team were so strong. The axis, if you will. Neuer, Hummels and Boateng, Kimmich, Müller up front. Those guys always performed. And before Kimmich, Lahm. Those guys always performed. And then you could sort of build a team around them. And it almost didn't really matter who else was playing there. Now, all of these guys, with the exception of Kimmich, are really struggling. They're playing so badly that people are saying maybe they're just past it. I mean, it's got to the point where the discussion is no longer, you know, when will they come back to being their normal selves, to is it really over for them? But Löw keeps persisting. And the kind of the younger generation who are coming in are perhaps not quite there yet. So this is a team that looks a little bit split in between sort of the stalwarts who are not quite performing and the young guns who are still a little bit raw and miss chances. Again, they had chances up front. Timo Werner had chances. Leroy Sané had a wonderful chance that he should have put away. And increasingly and most worryingly for me, it looks as if Löw is kind of second-guessing himself all the time. You know, his big idea after the World Cup was to go to a more reactive style with three midfielders and play more on the break. But then the Dutch are not stupid. They gave Germany the ball, and then Germany really, really struggled to do anything with it because they had three holding midfielders who none of them really offered that much going forward. And it just looks so stale at the moment, so bereft of ideas, no cohesion. And I think some of the problems we saw in Russia when it came to kind of a lack of a functioning kind of team dynamic, those issues still persist. If you look at the way that Hummels and all these guys talk about the game, and then you see how much more critical and aggressive almost the young guys are saying, you know, we need to improve, this is not good enough. They're not even on the same page off the pitch, let alone on it. So it's bad times, and a lot of people are casting Tuesday's game as a kind of a final for Löw,
right?
But perhaps for some of these players as well.
Who would come in if Löw? Would you think Löw might actually?
The argument is really the other way around. Löw is still there because no one else is able to come in. That's the key reason why he managed to survive Russia. It's also the key reason why the German FA, after such a terrible result and after a possible bad result on Tuesday, are still not quite ready to pull the trigger, because there is no obvious replacement. A lot of clamour for Matthias Sammer, who's now in an advisory role for Borussia Dortmund. And it might be coincidence, it might not be, but their fortunes have picked up remarkably over the last few weeks since he's taken over there, or since he's become involved there. I don't know if he wanted that much pressure, that much responsibility. And then you're really struggling to come up even with a potential name who might be available. All the good ones are iron jobs.
Would the FB ever consider going the kind of, you know, the foreign route? Or is that seen as a kind of a huge swallowing of pride?
I think it'd be very, very difficult to do. They got very close when they had the really dark days and at the turn of the century, where Gus Hiddink was in the running, and I think they talked to one or two Swiss coaches as well at the time. I think even Roy Hodgson got a call, a preliminary inquiry by Egidius Brown at the time. So, no, I think it's something that German FA cannot do, because they would feel it would just kind of signify a capitulation.
Right.
When it comes to having ideas and having coaches.
I think I know what Daniel was getting at. And
Big Sam, isn't it?
Alan Pardew is through.
Oh, come on, guys.
Yeah.
We're already... How the mighty have fallen, you know? Now the butt of jokes. 4 years ago, world champions.
Incredible. I thought that there was meant to be this conveyor belt of talent.
Talent is there. I think that is the redeeming point to all of this. There is enough talent. Okay, you might not have an out-and-out centre-forward, but Germany haven't had one for years. Even Klose was more of a playing striker, and it didn't hold them back. There is enough talent there, but you need a coach who has an idea and has the right players for it. At the moment, he seems a little bit torn between doing two things, none of which are quite feasible at this point.
I see.
A word for the Netherlands.
Yes.
You know, I don't think they are...
Lekker would be the word.
I don't think they're back.
What does that mean?
Tasty.
Oh, okay, all right.
Yeah, I don't think they're back, but what they do have potentially is the best centre-half pairing in international football in the next 3, 4, 5 years, because we know Virgil van Dijk is solid, and in Matthias de Ligt they have possibly the next big thing in central defending, I think. I think Barcelona certainly thinks so. So, yeah, when the Dutch fell to their lowest ebb, it was not because they were having to play Ryan Barber, which they are still having to do, but because they were capitulating in games and they were shambles. And that element of their decline could be over, I think.
Tuesday night, Daniel, are you going to be watching the France-Germany game or Holland taking on Belgium in what would be a sizzling game, although admittedly just a friendly?
Yeah, I probably will watch the end of Jurgen Löw.
But you'll tape it for that. Yeah.
The Dutch team also has probably my new favourite footballer name.
Okay.
Denzel Dumfries.
That is good.
Who sounds like the result of one of those Twitter memes that says, oh, your Dutch fullback name is the first name of your favourite action movie star and your favourite Scottish town.
Bruce Aberdeen.
Jean-Claude Dundee.
Listeners, come rain or shine, your friends here at Muddy Knees Media deliver a whole host of podcasts to your ears every single week. And that's why we're giving the thumbs up to ShipStation. Yep, ShipStation, America's number one e-commerce shipping software, is now available in the UK. Why is that exciting, you may ask? Well, if you're selling online, you want to get your orders out quickly and keep your customers happy. And that's where ShipStation comes in. ShipStation imports your online orders from anywhere you sell, from eBay to Amazon and even your own web store. So whether you dispatch one package per day or thousands per week, ShipStation is the shipping software for you. You'll get orders out fast and keep your customers happy. Happy customers mean more orders, and that is good for business. Because you listen to The Totally Football Show, you can try ShipStation free for 30 days, plus get a special bonus when you use the promo code SHOW. Just visit ShipStation.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in SHOW. That's ShipStation.com, ShipStation, and enter the promo code SHOW. ShipStation.com. Get ship done.
Loads of fascinating things to come, listener, including Rafa explaining what Bayern are doing down in sixth in the Bundesliga. But in other surprising football news, Italy win Sunday night, massive game away to Poland. A 1-0 victory at the death for the Azzurri, which means that Poland get relegated just when we all thought that was going to be Italy's fate. And the Gazetta this morning full of all this talk about how this team, just when you think they're dead, they come back and bite you in the bum. In this case, via Cristiano Buragi's late goal, the fullback sliding in to stick away the ball from a corner and basically earning Mancini his first competitive win as Italy manager. Did you see the game, actually, Jack?
Saw highlights.
All right.
It looked to me as if Italy were kind of camped on the edge of the Poland area for long
periods. Yeah, they look really good. I mean, there are a couple of things. They do need a centre-forward because they create so many chances. And even in the first minute, they'd hit the post once. They hit the woodwork a couple of other times. But they were all over Poland. And this new system, which, to be fair, Mancini had already tried out in the 1-1 draw at home to Ukraine, functioned brilliantly. The front three of Benedeschi, Insigne and Chiesa looked wonderful. But, I mean, the key thing was Marco Verratti coming back into the team and anchoring the midfield alongside Jorginho. And they just looked great. They now have a chance with this victory of actually reaching the finals ahead of Portugal, depending on what happens, when they take them on. Of course, they lost 2-1 last time. Those two sides faced each other.
Odd that Poland didn't play Krzysztof Piątek, I thought, given that he'd opened his account against Portugal. And
that's
actually
true.
So potent in Italy.
Mm. That is very true. Poland losing that game, that was back last week, wasn't it? 3-2. And Portugal, who were playing brilliantly at the moment, as you know, we heard earlier, winning that game, the Portuguese press called that one of their best performances in years, which has raised all sorts of interesting questions about their future, given that Cristiano Ronaldo wasn't actually playing. Piątek did score in that game, as you mentioned, and then lots of people called Silva. Andre Silva, who's about the only man keeping pace with Piątek in the European leagues. Rafa Silva kind of provoked an own goal from Glick, and then Bernardo Silva was a bit of a special one. Lots of papers saying that Maurizio Sarri wants to buy Piątek for January. but I think the Italian clubs, lots of big Italian clubs sniffing around him as well. Hey, in other international news, moving along, listeners, Gibraltar. Yes. Mm. Go on, Daniel.
Yeah, they won their first ever competitive match. And Armenia's new coach lost his first game in charge at home to Gibraltar, having had, I think, 35 shots they registered.
Wow.
But yeah, this is what the Nations League is all about. This is about, you know, for so long it was decreed that the way for the minnows to improve was to play the bigger clubs and kind of have this stars in their eyes improvement. And actually, I think the opposite is probably true. I think playing teams slightly better than them is the way to improve, with the carrot of a potential Euro 2020 place for a League D nation. You know, the likes of Kosovo, who are, you know, potential qualifiers for Euro 2020. It's brilliant for them. And as I say, Gibraltar's first ever competitive win. And I enjoyed the fact that before the game, Armenia played the Liechtenstein national anthem by mistake. And
caused, by mistake?
Well, I think it was a genuine mistake, but by all accounts, it really caused a lot of anger amongst the Gibraltar officials. And they kind of have that two fingers up after the game. So it's, you know, that they won their first game after that.
Right. You mentioned it was the first game in charge for Armenia's new manager. I didn't catch his name.
It's Armin. His first name's Armin, and that's how I will know him as, and so will you, I presume.
Gül Budagyants.
There you go.
Or some variation thereof. Extraordinary, because that was a proper Armenian side with Henrik Mkhitaryan playing, or Mkhitaryan playing the full 90 as well.
Yeah, and as I say, the ability to go into a match not thinking how many we're going to lose by, and considering it's success if you lose 5-0, it is a completely different psychology for a team, and it can only help improve those players. And also for countries like Gibraltar, the knock-on effect of these results is not just the improvement in the players there, but it persuades players who would be eligible for that nation to then consider becoming international footballers for Gibraltar, which is a huge, huge impact.
Right, fantastic. I wonder who their goalkeeper was. 35 shots and kept a clean sheet. That's pretty impressive. In other slightly surprising international news, Egypt took on Eswatini. Eswatini. Do you know where that is?
I saw that in a newspaper and I thought it was a typo.
Yeah, it's Swaziland.
Okay.
Yeah, what used to be known by some as Swaziland, but they call themselves Eswatini. And this was a 1-0 win for Egypt. The surprise being that the goal scored by Mo Salah, who I thought had retired, or he certainly talked of retiring, didn't he?
There was a fallout over his image rights, wasn't there? And
okay.
I think that has been sorted out now.
Okay.
Or at least postponed.
That's good, because he managed to score from a corner, an Olympico, is that right?
Yep, Olympic goal.
An Olympic goal, sorry. Yep. Right. And then went off injured.
Yes.
It's a muscle strain.
Apparently so.
Yeah. Okay, well, get well soon, Mo. Very good. Well, I'm sure there's loads of other international news, but Google it if you're that interested, listeners. We're going to move on after this. Hey, we're talking about that Thierry Henry news.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsors of Melchester Rovers. Find out more at RoyTheRoversOfficial.com.
In the Totally Football League show this Tuesday, Caroline and co are going to be speaking to Rochdale striker Judd Thompson about how he came back from cancer twice. They'll also round up all the goals from League One and Two, go Portsmouth, and give their thoughts about the Dean Smith and John Terry double act at Aston Villa, a job that, of course, was turned down by Thierry Henry, who instead, for reasons best known to himself, decided to take over at Monaco, down at the Louis II. What? Why? How many? Let's ask our French correspondent, Julien Laurent.
Bonjour, bonjour.
Jules, everyone's talking about it. It's Thierry Henry's move to Monaco. Is this going to be a Zidane-esque appointment, or a Pep at Barcelona, or more of the kind of Tony Adams down at Portsmouth?
Yeah, or Gary Neville at Valencia.
Exactly.
That's the question. I mean, I don't think even Thierry knows himself. What certainly is that he really fancied that project more than the Bordeaux one that he almost took a month ago, or the Aston Villa one, where he was clearly the favourite as well. And I think there was a time where he was tempted by the Villa job. But clearly this one, maybe because it's Monaco and that's where it all began for him, you know, all those years ago. Maybe because he feels that it's better to start in Ligue 1 than in a championship. You know, I don't know, but he felt like really this one ticked all the boxes for him, or most of the boxes for him, that he was, an interesting squad for sure, with a lot of talent, albeit after a really bad start of the season, but still, I think there's a lot of talent in there. He wants to work with young players, and he's got plenty at Monaco as well. Obviously, the language, there won't be a problem there. The league is probably a bit easier than the other leagues where he could have started. There's no pressure from media, from the fans, and there won't be pressure from the club either, because, to be fair, they can only do better than what they've done so far with only one win in 12 in all competitions. So I can see why he decided to take it. I still think it's a gamble on his side and on Monaco's side, but I guess he had to start somewhere, and he felt that was the best place to start.
Good place to do your gambling, of course, Monte Carlo. But does this mean that after selling off several teams' worth of talent, that Monaco are actually going to back him in the January transfer window?
So Monaco said it was always going to happen anyway, them spending money in January to sort of not reassess the squad, but maybe rebalance the squad in a way where currently the squad is far too young compared to what they had before, and there's a lack of experience and maybe a bit of lack of talent as well. So I think anyway, whoever would have, you know, regardless of who would be the manager in January, they were always gonna spend. But he got that assurance as well, and he also got the fact that going forward, and he signed a 3-year deal, that you know, maybe they would look at not selling too good players at the same time, which is exactly what they did the last 2.5 years, but that maybe going forward now, maybe one or two would go, but not 4 or 5 in one go.
Jules, you said there's no pressure from the fans, but I read that there is a bit of a split. 5-4, 5 against, Jerry.
No, I mean, I think people are excited over there for the ones who are going to the stadium and who are like Monaco fans, that between him and someone else that had no ties to the club or no link with the club, I think they would rather someone like him. The issue is, which is obvious one, is, you know, he's got no experience at all. So one, he's never been in a situation as a manager. And two, even less in a club a little bit in crisis, because they're third from bottom and right now they're going into a relegation playoff. So, you know, that's the big question mark. How is he going to do? Is someone who was so demanding of himself and of others when he was playing that you do wonder how is he going to be at training and during matches if the players he has are not playing at the level he expects them to be or he demands them to be? How will he react to that? Is he going to lose his temper? Is he going to be a bit patient? Is he going to be, you know, that's the big question. And I think he will find out as well. I'm sure he doesn't even know himself. But we will see at Strasbourg this weekend how he all goes.
Yeah, interesting. Because then not long till Monaco host Nice, which will mean a reunion with Patrick Vieira, who's applying his trade on the Nice managerial bench. What about Leonardo Jardim then, who by all accounts had kind of given up and was doing treasure hunts and archery with the team before matches?
Yeah, I mean, he's right now with a cocktail on a beach somewhere with a cheque of €8 million. So I think he'd be happy. I think he's fine for now. I think we can all agree he's pretty okay for now. The thing with Jardim, and that's, I think he was happy to go. And I think as much as it looks like they sacked him, I think he was far more of a mutual concern than what we, you know, what we actually think, because he felt it was the end of the road for him as well. I think he ran out of ideas. I think he ran out of energy as well. It's funny because Monaco, in his last press conference before his last game, there was only 10 journalists turned up. And that really shocked people. People at the club were like, hang on a minute, this is not, you know, it looked like their club was meaningless again, like they were a few years ago when they were in the second division. And I think as much as they wanted a young manager, up and coming, that kind of thing, they also wanted someone with a big name to sort of bring back Monaco into the news, you know, into people talking about it, which had gone really in the last few weeks under Jardim. And I think Jardim also felt it. And also he felt it was the right time for him to go, that he couldn't take this team forward anymore after, well, we're, you know, they were incredible 4 years, the ones he had at the club. And I can see why he was okay by leaving and getting that big check as well.
Absolutely. Jules, just finally then, a word for Rafa ahead of Tuesday's game between France and Germany.
I don't want to pile more misery on you, Rafa, and your team. I hope it's some sort of a good draw for Germany, but I think France are going to win. Sorry.
Hey, Rafa. Last time you were in, you were waxing lyrical about Niko Kovac, who was doing such a fine job with Bayern Munich at that point. They'd won 7 games in a row. However, as we pick up the story, they are now four games without a win and have just been beaten 3-0 by Borussia Mönchengladbach. And everyone's talking about how Niko Kovac is going to get the chop. So what's gone wrong?
It hasn't come to the point yet where he is seriously in danger of losing his job. Right now, there are there's more criticism of the board's transfer policy. They're saying that a little bit like Joachim Löw, maybe, that they overestimated the performance levels of some of the more experienced members of the squad, that there should have been more of a transition. But it is quite remarkable how not just the results, but also the perception of Kovac has changed in such a short time. And I think having researched this for a story I did for ESPN, the explanation I've been given by some of the players or people close to the players was that initially there was a lot of emphasis on fitness and on defensive stability, and Bayern played with real energy and they were solid at the back, and their superior quality, even if you think that Robin and Ribéry are slightly over the hill, they are still better than 90% of the opposition in the Bundesliga, and put that energy and that momentum all together and defensive solidity and you had a winning combination. The problem is, I think that a lot of coaches have looked at this Bayern team and says, yes, okay, they're still very good, but actually what they're doing is very, very basic. They're just attacked from the flanks, they're put man forward, the fullbacks are overloading, and if we shut down the wings, there is not a lot they've got. They've been running into trouble in recent games, and when even Dieter Hecking kind of out-coaches you, the players pick up on it, and the players expected things to change at half-time. You know, they really were not doing well. They expected tactical changes, positional changes, but Kovac did very little. And I wouldn't say that he has already lost the dressing room, but I think they're beginning to wonder whether he actually, with his very limited experience of coaching attacking football, he's come from Eintracht Frankfurt, where they played a very kind of muscular, robust, but mostly counter-attacking style, whether he has the ideas, whether he has the solutions. And as long as Bayern are winning, those doubts will not come to the forefront. But the minute that the results go against them, and they had now, as you said, four games without a win, at a place like Bayern, immediately you will find players who, for their own reasons, will leak that lack of belief, that lack of trust in lack of confidence in the players, to in the coach, to the wider media, and then the board will have to make a decision. Right now, I think they want to stick with him because it reflects very badly on them if they get rid of him, because A, it says they got the wrong man, and B, it says actually they should have changed the squad.
But they got rid of Carlo Ancelotti about this point of the season, didn't they?
Yes, they did. But of course, Ancelotti had been there the year before with success. But the doubts already by then had become quite big. And I think the difference then was that he managed not just to lose the confidence when it came to tactics and all this stuff, but also made too many decisions that riled the serious players. They kind of complained and said they could no longer understand what he was doing. And I think at that point, Bayern felt that they had to pull the plug, because they, I think, had begun to kind of almost subconsciously undermine them, as teams have a you know, history of doing, almost kind of as some kind of self-help emergency measure. We have to almost lose to get rid of this guy, otherwise things won't improve. It hasn't come to that point yet, but he's under serious pressure now, Kovac, to win over the next few games.
Sixth in the Bundesliga.
It's great for the league.
Top of the table are Borussia Dortmund. Are they going to win the title? And how big a star in Germany is Jadon Sancho?
Are they going to win a title? I would hope so. I think it would be great for everyone concerned. I think you still have to expect Bayern to bounce back, and Dortmund cannot possibly win games all the time the way they did last Saturday, a week ago, when they beat Augsburg 4-3, scoring three goals in the last, 6 minutes. You know, that's not sustainable. They have been scoring an unbelievable amount of goals, 18 in the last four games, playing wonderful football. Jadon Sancho is a key part in all of that. He's becoming much more of a regular now, and his decision-making has become much better. Also, I think under Lucien Favre, Dortmund have real structure when it comes to their attacking game. There's some really interesting remarks in a Sportbild piece where substitutes, and they've scored a lot through substitutions, were talking about the fact that Favre looks at the team and he looks for 45 minutes at the opposition, and he will just then take a piece of paper and say, here's their weak spot, you just run this way, come from that angle, and this is where the chances will be created. And it's great when it works, because as a player you think, wow, you know, I just need to listen to this guy more often. And that is the positive momentum that you have right now. Sancho is big, but because he is a foreigner, and B, just one of a number of interesting sort of young attacking talent that Dortmund have, there isn't that hype to make him something he isn't at this point. And I think Dortmund, talking to one or two players, were even a little bit, I wouldn't say annoyed, but maybe surprised in a slightly negative way that he'd already been called up. Because I think they would have liked to keep him a little bit more on the wraps, seeing him develop, and then for the big hype train to start. I think Southgate, to his credit, has handled it well so far. But I think it does create sort of unwanted attention, I think, and makes it a little bit more difficult for him to just do his job and just learning the ropes at Dortmund.
Anyway, Rafa, speaking of up-and-coming players, that Per Mertesacker game you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. 40,000 people turned up in Hanover to wave goodbye to Per, who, of course, started his career there. He's a local boy, and he cried on the lap of honour. It was all very moving. He was also a little bit annoyed that some of his former teammates had pulled out very late. And didn't show up. He said, "You wouldn't have deserved to be here."
So, who blew him out?
Well, Michael Ballack was supposed to be there and cancelled very late on with a flu. Peter Cech, but I think apparently he was genuinely injured, so he wouldn't have been included in that. Yeah, one or two others, like Jiri Steiner and people like that. But yeah, it was a really great occasion, a moving farewell, and a fitting finale with the slight annoyance of having Scooter provide the halftime entertainment. But it did give everyone the opportunity to do the bit of a pun with a "Hi, Per, Hi, Per, Hi, Per."
Nice, yeah. Nice. Hey, we could play out with a bit of Scooter.
No, please not.
Actually, we won't, because we've got something else. Anyway, that brings us pretty much to the end of today's Totally Football show. But of course, let's just get the odds on some of the things we've been talking about today before we shut up shop. Producer Ben's been speaking to Paddy Power.
Thanks, Jimbo. It's Lee Price on the line from Paddy Power. Lee, let's get stuck right into Scotland. They're rubbish. Is Alex McLeish going to survive?
It's not been great, has it? And McLeish is definitely under pressure, but he hasn't even had a qualifying campaign in charge yet, so it would be very drastic. But then again, he only had 10 games during his first stint in charge, so not impossible. We go 11-4 that he's sacked before the end of the year, which would be slightly surprising, but their recent performances, can you blame them?
Well, I'm interested to know how that compares to Jogi Löw's predicament. We've had Rafa in the studio today talking all about the problems there. Tell us about his long-term employment issues and about the game against France. I reckon France are going to score 3 or more. What do you think?
So with Joachim Löw, actually, he's less safe than Alex McLeish, so that's at least one win for the Scotland manager. It's just 2-1 that Löw is gone by the end of this year. As for 3 or more goals for France, it's just 5-2. It's odds on they score 2 or more, so Germany under the cosh. It always feels dangerous to write Germany off, though, and they're 7-2 to win in France, which is a massive price.
Well, let's make this a hat-trick of bad managers, or managers having a bad time of it, rather. Martin O'Neill at Ireland, they were really, really bad against Denmark. What's going to happen when they take on Wales?
Yeah, they were really bad, but they still managed to ruin my ACCA and my big tip of the weekend that Denmark were a dead cert. So cheers, Ireland. I had to sit through that and I didn't win money. They're 7-5 to beat Wales, and they need to if they want to avoid relegation. 15-8 for the draw looks good value. 2-1 for Wales. The 0-0, by the way, is just 5-1, and I'd be very tempted by that.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com. All prices are accurate at the time of recording. 18 plus only. BeGambleAware.org. And when the fun stops, stop. Thursday's Totally Football show features the vocal talents of Duncan Alexander, Emma Saunders and James Horncastle, where we'll have lots of things to get excited about, including the return of the Premier League and Chelsea Man United. Ooh. Have you got a big week ahead of you, Raf?
I have, actually, yes. I'm going to Poland to launch the Polish version of Bring the Noise.
Brilliant. Okay, super.
Yeah. Polish listeners out there, you'll find me in Warsaw and Krakow.
That's great news. Daniel, what about you?
Book writing, shutting myself away and not getting distracted.
Excellent. Jack?
Well, I best get back to my skirting situation, yes. James.
Well, I hope you have something equally delightful awaiting you, listener. We'll leave you, though, today with another Peter Brackley memory. Peter, the voice of Football Italia and Pro Evolution Soccer, from all of us here It's arrivederci.
No, oh, he's charged the goalkeeper. Oh, that's torn it. Hey, do you agree with that call, Trevor? Huh? Oh? Hmm? Oh! Ah! Yes! Great! Go for it! Go on! Oh, well done! Hey? Ah? What? Oh, no! Oh! Hmm. Oh, my. Hmm, yes?
Oh, no!
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. And make sure you check out our other football podcasts, the revamped Totally Football League Show with Caroline Barker and the brand new Totally Scottish Football Show. Supporting your team can be a beautiful thing, but then come the injuries, the goal droughts and the downright disastrous defeats. That's a little bit like life, really. And here at the Totally Football Show, we believe we should all support each other the way we support our team, through the good days and the bad. And that's why we're continuing to work with CALM, the Campaign Against Living Miserably, a charity dedicated to preventing male suicide. On average, 12 men take their own life every day in the UK. So that's your starting 11 and your manager every single day. And part of the problem is that many of us still feel uncomfortable talking about mental health and suicide, and this can often stop men from opening up and getting support when they need it the most. So if you're worried that someone close to you is having a tough time, check in with them and let them know that CALM is there. Every day from 5pm till midnight, CALM provide a free, confidential and anonymous helpline and web chat for any man who needs support. Visit thecalmzone.net to find out more about CALM.